Thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. And to be totally honest, the more we researched into like you and what you've done, the more I was like, dang, this is crazy that you're going to come on and chat to us, because like you're potentially one of the most prolific YouTubers that we've seen on the platform.
I appreciate it.
Okay, so can I give some context for everybody? So Andre started a YouTube channel, and you were, you know, gaming with your friends. I think you were 15 at the time, and you were just wanting to listen to music, create your own playlists, whatever it is on YouTube. And so you create this platform, and just to bring a bit of context, like right now there's like something like, I think, 37 million YouTube channels. A lot of those probably are not active, but it gives you like a bit of sense of like what the ecosystem looks like. And I looked on some stats, and it looks like Trap Nation is still like number 120 or something like that in regards to subscribers, which is crazy. Like the total nations group has like more than 50 million subscribers. And so like, this is like a social phenomenon. Like I was talking to someone that I live with earlier last night. And as soon as I mentioned it, it kind of brings back like memories for them as a childhood in using that to stream music, because we didn't have Spotify and stuff like that back in the day. Is that right? And so I guess the question is like, did it really just form naturally? And at what point did you realize like, oh, this is potentially like something that could be a business model or monetized, if that makes sense?
Yeah. I mean, to answer the first question, yeah, it was all like just a hobby, honestly. Like I'm not like, I wouldn't consider myself like any super intelligent, like smart, like book, at least book smart individual. It was kind of just something where I wanted to share my music tastes, and I was on YouTube prior to this as well. Like some people think I just magically created a YouTube channel and I blew up. I had YouTube channels before. I had a gaming channel, I had a vlog channel. Oh, okay. And I just enjoyed doing it. So I was like, oh, I saw this, I saw UKF dubstep, which was like, I would consider like the pivotal moment where YouTube curators started to pop up on YouTube, or like, I guess like music channels and YouTube started to pop up. It was around like UKF dubstep's like incarnation or whatever. And I saw them and I was like, oh, this is really dope. I love dubstep. And then it just started like a music channel similar to UKF dubstep, but for trap music. And then, yeah, I mean, I never honestly thought it would blow up, dude. I mean, it was one of those things that you just start and you keep doing it. You don't understand actually how much time it's taken to build the channel or do your hobby, because you're doing it for fun. You're not doing it, you know, for incentive or to make money or whatever it is, or build a business. And then once I got to the point where it would really hit the flywheel effect, I was smart enough and fortunate enough to be able to not have to go to like college, but also spend more time in my high school career, like take it really seriously. I also had great parents growing up as well, so they let me kind of like, they weren't super strict with my education.
Yeah, that's cool. And so we've seen that Trap Nation has over 30 million subscribers on YouTube. It's got a video with 500 million views. I believe it's a Chainsmokers mix. One thing I noticed is that there doesn't seem to be, correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't seem to be direct monetization through the typical AdSense method. Is that because all the content is like remixes of other people's mixes, or is it I also noticed that there's links to Spotify and links to merch and like heaps of other community building like links underneath. Is that where the monetization opportunity comes from like the nation's channels?
That's a really good question. I've actually never been asked that before. So the monetization on YouTube, it's in a traditional format. It's not through AdSense, through an MCN, multi-channel network that advertises or gets advertisers placed on our videos. They're all licensed, like officially licensed. We have major label or deals with every major label. Artists are paid out, you know, royalties on almost all the uploads. That's taken about 6-7 years just to do that alone. When I first started the channel, it was really just like, oh, I'd upload it, no licensing agreements, you know, nothing. And it was just free nilly-willy. And then obviously, you know, major labels cracked down on that, not just me, but also just YouTube as a whole, because they didn't have licensing agreements with YouTube yet. And then that's when we really actually had to start doing like due diligence with everything. So that's the primary actual revenue stream of the nations. And then We don't really make much money on merch or live events or any of the other affiliate links. And I don't even think we do have affiliate links in there. It's just, you know, just helping build artists, you know, careers and communities through there. The other source of income really is through actually through our record label. So a lot of the content we publish on our YouTube channel, we also have a record label attached to that content. And that's was started primarily because we'd put on artists, right? And they would gain, you know, 750,000, a million. This is like top tier Trap Nation, a million views in 3 days in the channel. And then all of a sudden these labels would come in and swoop them up, you know, sign predatory deals. And my thought was like, well, I'm missing out on a massive revenue stream where I could just go out and sign like 50-50 deals flat out with artists. They own their own rights in perpetuity. Obviously, we're just licensing it for a short period of time. And I can start like a giant Spotify kind of playlist, you know, mega dome around my label and just be able to market and push these songs a lot harder than any of the labels ever wish they could have. So that's kind of like our secondary revenue stream, which is actually now our primary revenue stream, the record label.
Huh, that's awesome. So question more introspectively, like how much of what's happened right now would you attribute to like any kind of plan or intelligence that you had versus like just being in the right place at the right time? Like, have you thought about that? Because like, this is a pretty crazy experience that you've had.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about it. Trust me, more than any other thought I could think of or could have thought of. Honestly, I think it's a mix of both. Like, I looking back at it, I think my strength is in ability to take advantage of opportunities and understand when those opportunities are occurring. And I'm a firm believer. Everybody has luck in life. Some people have a little bit more than others, but everybody has luck. The thing is, like, people are like, oh, I'm never lucky. I never had an opportunity. Most people have. They just haven't actually realized it. They haven't seen it or they didn't take advantage of it at the time. And for me, I definitely took advantage of it. Definitely right place, right time. But I think I'm also a big believer. It's like I feel like a good listener as well. Like I never think I'm the one in the room that has the right decision. And that can be actually pretty fatal in certain situations that I'm in. But also, like, I'm very good at listening at feedback. And a lot of the progress of the Nations and the label, like, the label wasn't my idea. Somebody gave me the idea to start the label. Building subsidiary channels was not my idea. Somebody gave me that idea, you know, and I just like acted on it because I'm like, oh, that's a good idea. Like, I should do that. But, you know, it's just taking in the right advice and just acting on it. And I think I'm just very good at executing as well. Like, most people don't know this about me, but I can take decent photos. I'm a photographer. I would consider myself like a pretty advanced like graphic designer. I know After Effects in and out. I know Premiere Pro, Lightroom, you know, Photoshop. You know, I can do a lot of different skills, and wearing those hats really is pretty crucial when you're starting a company, because, you know, obviously you save a lot of money. So that also was a huge help as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really cool. One thing that I thought was really cool about the Nations and Trap Nation and everything is nations.io. So you hover over a little map, which is really well designed, and it shows each of the associated channels, like R&B Nation, Latin Nation, Indie Nation, House Nation. So that's a really cool like little display of everything, and I think that it shows the. It looks like the most recent upload for each day is kind of uploaded there. And so people can kind of go to it and source their own little genre, depending on what they like. My question is, so there's 8 channels, I think. So how do you source so much content to like post daily on each one? Because one thing that I saw was like, there's literally so much, like it's crazy. So it would be like a logistical nightmare to source so much. And initially my thought was, these are SoundCloud mixes with a cool graphic and a cool, you know, stock footage in the background. But I think that, from what it sounds like, what you've been saying is it's a little more sophisticated now with getting a label up and running and actually signing, contract deals with the artists.
Yeah, totally. I mean, logistically, honestly, I think I mastered it once with Trap Nation. Like, I understand and built that channel. And I think, like, I also work very, like, on the ground. I'm not, like, a good, like, executive or high-level person, I'll truthfully say. I'm better at doing ground-level work and building things up and then handing them off to people to do. So once I did that with Trap Nation, it was pretty easy for me to just build. I'm not exaggerating, like a 20-page document that just described exactly how I built the channel, how I run it every day, what I do, how I render it from After Effects, like everything. And I would just basically hand that off, assuming I'm writing it in the point of view of like, if I'm a reader, I know nothing about how to start a YouTube channel about music. And that's basically how we scaled up so many channels so quickly. And I'm also pretty good, I believe I'm pretty good with building up our operations logistics. So, you know, we have like rights management people, we have, you know, people that make sure that like every single upload is always cleared with the record labels, there's contract signs, like the whole, you know, nine yards. So we built that foundation after Trap Nation kind of blew up, and then we started to integrate that foundation, those operation principles with all the other channels. And that's kind of like how it's been run for the last like 7 years, and then, you know, continually today.
Yeah, wow. Okay, that's really cool. Okay, so you made like, you can make a document that explains how it works. I was looking, do you know what the biggest YouTube channel at the moment by subscribers is? It's a channel called T-Series. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
Yeah, I'm very familiar, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like an Indian music record label that put stuff up there. And it's crazy. Like, it's like more than double Mr. Beast, and everyone's heard of Mr. Beast. The question for you is, like, you mentioned the document and the ability to scale multiple channels, which clearly that's like an example of like, this is more than just luck, because you can replicate it. You can't replicate luck. And yeah. So like, could you highlight a couple of like practical tips that you would give to someone if it was like, you know, I'm trying to start, you know, my own channel. I don't know if it's specific to music, YouTube. What would be like a couple of practical tips that you would say generally work that you've seen?
Yeah. I mean, today, man, it's much more difficult to start a YouTube channel off of the ground today than it was. I'm not going to lie. Like in 2015, it was a lot easier because the saturation wasn't there. But I would say like tips, honestly, like find your niche of what you want to do. Focus on how you get people to watch your videos as long as possible. And these are like general tips that most content creators probably already know, or at least should know, in my opinion. But YouTube's algorithm constantly changes. So like YouTube's algorithm when I started was not the same algorithm, and it didn't prioritize content the same way that it does today. And that might be true for next year as well. So I would say always stay in tune with like YouTube's algorithm, and you can just simply do that just by YouTube, honestly going on YouTube and looking up like how to get my videos seen, how to create attractive thumbnails. Because I think from a logistics standpoint, or just like attention like grabbing standpoint, you want to be able to find your niche, grab your target demographic, figure out who that target demographic is, grab them through like a clickable thumbnail or a title. The way you can get seen is by prioritizing SEO through your title and description. And then your biggest priority beyond that should be ensuring those people stay in your videos as long as possible. Because I know for a fact on YouTube, if somebody clicks your video and they hop off, you're done. Like your video is not going to get recommended.
Is that potentially worse than if someone had never watched it in the first place from an algorithm standing point?
That's a good question. Yes, it's probably worse, because I guess from a YouTube's algorithm, it just shows like, hey, somebody clicked it, they're not interested. And
yeah,
I feel like that's worse than like somebody not clicking it at all, honestly.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Wow.
So Soundmin is the new NFT platform that we'll move on to. So there's a focus on curation, carefully selecting the best music and visuals for each drop. So the part that stood out to me the most seems to be that everything's organized into stems. So it seems very similar to Kanye West's stem player, where you know, you swipe around different bars and isolate the drums and isolate the percussion and vocals and everything. So basically, you can change around the vocals and everything. The stems are created individually by the artists, and then the Soundmin algorithm blends them together using like one bass, one vocal, one percussion stem, and essentially meaning that Soundmin has this unique way of making the art generative, right? So what's the method that the system actually uses to make the sound actually sound good? Because one thing that I noticed is all of them sound really good, and it just doesn't make logical sense that an artist could make four different tracks, for example, and then you have a system right. That's just like, yep, this is good, like
yeah. That's a good question. It's pretty simple. I mean, I think music is one of those things that it has this like God, almost like God complex, the industry as a whole, because not everybody loves it, right? But not a lot of people understand how it's made or how it works or the music business of it. And obviously, I had come up with that to an advantage in Web3 and NFTs to some extent. But it's very simple. So the same script, the same algorithm that like every blue chip NFT project or every generative PFP project uses, where it's taking like 150, 250, whatever number it is, visual layers, and randomly combining each layer together. We're using that same exact script, just with audio. The way it sounds good is because everything is made from an artist standpoint, from the artist perspective, in the same key and BPM, which basically just means like it's all going to sound harmonic when it's layered together. The best way to describe it is like, it's almost like collecting a jam session from your favorite artist, like, or a recording session from your favorite artist. Like, if you were to imagine Rihanna in the studio, you know, when she makes a song, it's not like she's going to the recording studio and everything's perfect for the first take and all of a sudden you have this perfect, you know, diamond in the rough song. It's complete opposite. Like, she's taking probably 40, 50, 60 different takes and then cutting it up, the recording sessions, and putting it all together. Then they record the drums and they record the beats, the instrumentals, and they put it all together into a song. There's all these unheard takes that, if they're all recorded in the same key and BPM, you could technically just create all these alternative versions of what a song could sound like, which is pretty interesting. So that's kind of like how it works on the generative side for the music. But we have like a few, like our CTO is a mad genius and he's created like a few things that have helped it sound better, like being able to send a reference file to a script or an algorithm, and it'll try to detect like what the mix and master is on it, and then it'll apply that mix and master to the generative collection. We also have like on-chain, like sidechain as well. I don't think it's on-chain, but it's just like a script of sidechain that helps sounds meld together, kind of. So those are the things that also help it sound better.
I noticed that mix mastering reference tool that I think you mentioned it in a different podcast I was watching. And like, I feel like that in and of itself is potentially like a really valuable product that you could potentially one day, like, I don't know, bring to the market. Like if, like in a non-Web3 sense, like if people were to, like people are getting their stuff mixed and mastered all the time, potentially remotely, like a lot of the time you just send it off and you send a reference. If that could be done like automatically, like that's crazy. But anyway, so I actually went onto the platform and I purchased an NFT because I was like, oh, what's the best way to like learn how this stuff works? And so the project was called We Are Cloud. And so the artist is Cloud. And I know you've got a bit of background with that artist, which is really cool. You've kind of brought them through the whole process of what you've been doing. And so it was number 399. I think it was $25. And so I went on to SoundMint. So first of all, I noticed SoundMint doesn't seem to be a marketplace. I don't know if there's a future there for that. So it takes you to OpenSea. You jump on there, you can connect your MetaMask wallet, buy it. And then you can go back, which I noticed, you can go back to the website. It verifies that, okay, now I have that NFT in my MetaMask wallet. And it allows me to locally download the stems. And then I guess I can do a bunch of stuff with that if that's what I want to do. I guess the question there is like, is that right? And what other additional features that I maybe haven't noticed yet might come along, or should we expect for collectors when they're buying these NFTs?
Yeah, so you're right in terms of what you're able to do. So we added a feature probably a few months after we released that collection that allows individuals to download the stems and the artwork and stuff like that to collections, not just the Cloud collection, but any collection moving forward as well, which I think is useful for like producers and musicians who want to take those, or even like people who want to sync them to commercial content or TV and film. You know, it's useful to have those stems. So that's something they've integrated. And then for Cloud specifically, or I guess like every collection, the utility and benefits are really reliant on the artist. Although from what we've experienced as a brand that kind of launched these two collections, our most recent two collections that we put out, it's difficult to entirely rely on the artist to commit to utility, I think, especially in market conditions like this, but also just in the music industry as a whole. So we're kind of telling artists to say, hey, like, don't commit to utility just to commit to utility or benefits. Like, truly think like, what is a low lift thing that you could do that actually provides value to these holders? So that's kind of our philosophy moving forward. And then we're also kind of taking a stance as a brand and platform, and I'll answer the marketplace question in a bit too, that we want to really focus on better user onboarding, build actual real value for these collectibles, not just from a digital standpoint, but also like potentially integrate like physical items not merchandise, but like actually a physical collectible that people can get through like a burn to redeem function or something like that. So that's kind of like a thing that we're working on as well. And then for the marketplace, we're right now still on ETH and we're still kind of like pushing people to OpenSea and other secondary marketplaces. But ultimately we want to get to a point where anybody can just come to our website, download our mobile app, you know, buy these collectibles with the Face ID, you know, Apple Pay, Android Pay or whatever, and they can trade and sell them within like a marketplace on our app that isn't necessarily reliant on like OpenSea. So that's kind of like our end goal vision, but we're pretty far away from that still. So we have time. We have to build those, you know, that repertoire in the community.
I actually, so I had a good play around with the STEM player. It was a lot of fun. It was so much fun. Like you just change the one track and then you change the next one and you're like, oh, that I didn't think it could sound better, but it actually does. And so we've seen a little teaser on the Twitter of what looked like a physical player. Within 24 hours of Kanye West launching his STEM player, he sold 11,000 units for $2.2 million in revenue. Do you think that, so there's a proof of concept there, do you think that was it just a visual representation of what's going on, or do you think that there's any room in the market for you guys actually to launch a STEM player that accompanies the NFT project?
No, I mean, that's honestly where our head's at. Like, we want to, like, Salmon is kind of like my last, like, I think this sounds insanely odd, but like Salmon, if the Salmon really succeeds and pushes forward, which I truly believe it will, it's my last like go at it. Like, I'm going to try and put my all into this company and then just like, you know, take it to the top. And that'll be my last company I ever start again, because it's so difficult starting a company. But back on track to like the collectible side, like, I truly believe our old angle vision is collecting music reimagined. How do we reimagine the process of collecting music? And that's not an easy feat, because the most relevant and most present way of collecting music still is vinyls, which is like super crazy. If you think of any other industry, you know, most industries innovate and progress, but in terms of the music industry, we're actually now selling and pressing more vinyls than we were when vinyls are the primary way of listening to music. And they're now just a novelty, to give you reference of like
that's crazy.
How interesting that is. So for us, like, we're really focused on, whether it's digital, whether it's physical, whether it's both, like, we're really just focused on reimagining the way people collect music. And where you've been looking to like building physical product as well, similar to kind of like a STEM player. I wouldn't say like that's like our number one priority right now is the STEM player in IRL, but we want to do things like that where you can buy this like collectible item that maybe plays with STEMs or plays your NFT, or maybe there's an augmented reality component to it, things like that.
Gotcha. Okay, that's really interesting. So from an artist perspective, you've had a couple of recent projects. I'm sure there's plenty more to come. What does it look like from their perspective? So obviously you're finding someone who aligns with what the brand is and what it looks like. And because it represents like the drops represent you guys. And so obviously it's super important to have someone that aligns. What's it look like from that perspective? Like from a practicality sense, like, are you bringing someone, like let's say Cloud, for example, bring them on board and saying, hey, we actually need to get you in the studio to record 50 drum tracks, 50, but let me book that for you. Let me get you in there. Is there an engineer from, you know, SoundMint who goes, yeah, that's all going to work for our algorithmic mechanism, or no, you know, that one's actually probably not going to work. Like, how involved are you in the process, or how much is it that they just bring their stems, put it in your algorithm, and it just works? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty involved, honestly. Like, so Paris, who also Salmon's not my idea, I was just co-founder of it, but Paris, who was an artist of the 15 years, he really started SoundMint. And his job primarily is like that engineer position. So he works directly with the artists that we onboard, and he ensures that like he can inspire them to creatively think about how to make music in a different way through this generative algorithm, because it is pretty foreign to most artists. And he also helps kind of like curve like, hey, this won't actually sound good, this will sound good. So his job primarily is to do that. So we are very, very intimately involved. And most collections so far have taken about 2-3 months of work, working with the artist management teams, a call every week, a Slack channel. Yes, we use Slack channel with the artists. And we're very, very involved with everything, honestly. But I think it's important, because our entire goal is like, we want an artist to not put this out as just something that lives digitally and they don't talk about it again. We want them to put it out like they're proud, they're confident, and they love what they're selling and marketing to their fans. And we would never want to put an artist in a position where they're just selling something because their management told them to. We want them to actually care and want to put something out. So that's why we're so intimately involved.
Gotcha. Yeah, I've heard you say that's really good that you put in like 2 months of effort or 3 months of effort or whatever into each drop, because I've heard you say before that every single drop has to be a home run. Because with the Nations channel, you upload it daily, but there was no financial interaction involved with the fans, you know. So if the community doesn't respond well to it, there's always tomorrow. They can come back tomorrow and the next day to see if they like the next Trap Nation mix, and they probably will come back because they're already loyal fans. The difference here is that there is a financial element in what you're creating. So how important is that that interaction? How you've changed the dynamic between yourself and the fans? How important is it to make like a really high quality product, or how important is it to just drop as much as you can? Like, is it quality or is it quantity that you're going for?
It's always quality. I mean, I think there's a balance between the two, because I think in the last like 6 months, like in retrospect, we've only put out 2 collections, right? And in any industry or any standard, if I'm talking to anybody about that, just that perspective right there, it's like 2 collections, 6 months. Like, why did you put out more? And it's not necessarily just because we're focused on quality. It was primarily just because there's a lot of learning curves in what we're building right now. It's new. Like, there's no model to follow after. We are creating the model as we speak currently. And it creates you have to experiment a lot to get there, really. So that's been kind of like the delay for these collections, because every time we onboard a new artist, you know, it's a learning curve. It's education every single time. And they're going to have different questions with the next artist. So moving forward, I would say we're getting better at pushing things faster and quicker without sacrificing quality. And we've integrated like principles, and specifically on the visual side, we were doing like a templated visual model now that will be like a digitized like vinyl, basically. So it's only really about the music. It's not so much about onboarding an artist with a visual artist now. It's more about like, hey, it's a musician and they use our Soundmint visuals. And that's been speeding up the process a lot. Which I actually think will help and get people to collect them more, because we can then control like the gamification of it, you know, user profile, add badges, add collecting rewards, things like that a lot easier.
Yeah, gotcha. And for all this, maybe in an ideal world, because as you say right now, you're kind of like learning and you're going through the process. In an ideal world, what's the goal for like the business model for Soundmint? Like where are you getting value for yourselves and, you know, paying staff and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, we're funded very luckily. I don't take a salary. Brian, our company, does not take a salary. Most people, the founders, really don't take any money from the project. We only have a few employees now. We're running very lean, I'd say, which we have to. I'd say the ultimate goal, though, like, I would love to take a salary. Obviously, I'm working, you know, 16-hour days right now, trying to figure out like what we're doing as a company and how to become a profitable company. That's my biggest focus right now. You know, do it without actually having to sacrifice like the product experience. And I think profit and money will come if you just focus on like the best experience for the fan as possible, specifically for us. And this happens with every industry, like Apple, they focus on the best experience for their products, you know, $1 trillion company. You know, you look at any industry, if you just focus on a better customer experience, a better fan experience, better product experience overall, it will scale and profit will come. So we really stopped thinking about like, you know, how do we necessarily make a ton of money? Although it's my number one objective, it really is going to come down to how to build the best product possible. And that's really where our focus lies right now.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, so the Twitter for Soundmint was started in late 2021, almost 1 year old now. You've built multiple brands and multiple pages to over a million followers, over you know, 10 million followers in some occasions. So how do you see, you're an expert in growing pages and brands, and since you've only done those 2 drops, and obviously the everything will kind of pick up as you kind of come into your economies of scale moment and really start to pick up pace, where do you see it being 1 year from now, and what are you kind of doing to kind of grow your brand image in terms of Soundmint to get it out to more people?
Yeah, that's a challenging question for sure. I would say like, I mean, I used to do interviews for Trap Nation, like I think like 6 years ago, they're like, what do you see in 3 years? And I'd always answer, I have no clue. Because it's so hard to like depict social media, like what's going to, you know, drive your brand results or what's not. I think for us, like right now, the way that we're going to build Soundmint's brand really is based on the artists that we bring on. Because if you think just from a customer acquisition model, right, like the easiest and cheapest customers to acquire in this standpoint from a business philosophy would be, you know, the fans of the artists, because we're bringing them on. There's no cost associated with bringing that on that artist other than time and resources. And then we're selling a collection, obviously, to their fans and potential collectors. So for me, those are the individuals. The fans are really going to be the individuals that become potential Soundmint fans as well, start following our brand and want to collect from multiple artists, not just one. So all the content, all the tweets, all the Instagram posts are all centered right now, moving forward, really around grabbing their attention and building and putting out, releasing meaningful content around the collections that they're collecting from. And to just give you an example, so it makes sense and it's not just words, the Sanho collection that we have coming out in a month from now, we did like a 10-minute interview at NFT NYC with him, basically just asking questions like, what was your artistic, you know, method building this collection? You know, why are you building a generative collection? Like, explain the breakdown of the stems. Like, what does it mean to you to build this collection? Things that really dive deep into like the creative side and the artistic side of what these collections actually are, because there's so much noise in the NFT industry, and that's really, you know, our job to do as a brand and platform, to be able to take that content and then share it so people can see it.
Gotcha. Okay, that's really cool. Is there, like, apologies if I'm ignorant here, but is there ever drops on Soundmint that are existing songs that already exist on DSPs, or are they always unique and distinct to the platform?
Right now, only unique and distinct, although moving forward, we might look into, like, you know, taking songs and remixing them or something like that as generative collections.
Right. And then what are the restrictions around intellectual property and copyright for use of those stems and tracks and stuff like that? And I know you mentioned being able to use that on ads and stuff. So obviously there is some commercialization that's allowed. What do you usually sort of say for stuff like that?
So we offer artists like a tier of different licensing methods. It's very similar to like what Artblocks does as well on their website. They allow their artists to choose different Creative Commons. For the first collection we did full commercial rights licensing, meaning if you buy a collection or a collectible, you can use it any way you see fit. You can use it in your music, content, etc. For Kai and Cruz, the second collection, we did CC0, which is like the max Creative Commons effect. And I don't think, I mean, we were first pretty bullish on CC0, then really after experimenting with it and looking into it, we just don't think it makes sense, because it's almost like you're relinquishing all your rights, and holders relinquish all their rights. And I feel like people don't necessarily want that or to spend money on that. Moving forward, it's up to the artists. We always encourage at least like non-commercial rights for the holders, which means like you can download stems, you can use it in YouTube, SoundCloud, but you can't like make a song with it and put it on Spotify or something like that.
Yeah, gotcha.
And then it changes per tier artist. Like if you think of like a Drake wouldn't want you to do anything with his music, most likely. If you're talking about like a small producer out of Toronto or, you know, Montreal or something, that can be anywhere really, but you know, they might be more willing to let you use their music in any way, you know, that you see fit.
Okay. Yeah, cool.
All right. Trap Nation, the Nation's Soundmint, dropping crazy stem collections. He's on YouTube, he's on Spotify, he's only 25. Andre Benz, how can people find out more about what's coming up?
You can just follow Soundmint, at SoundmintXYZ on Twitter, or you can follow me. I tweet, you know, sometimes about like what we're working on at Soundmint as well, at Ben Speaks on Twitter.
Excellent.
Thank you so much. It always feels quick when it's like an interesting conversation. And so thank you so much for coming on.
Of course, man. I appreciate it.